Hello, I'm Razia Iqbal and I'm in New York, where I'm joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. She's a pioneer for gender equality and recently won the $1 million Berggruen Prize, awarded annually to a thinker whose ideas have profoundly shaped human understanding and advancement.
What does it mean to you to have won this?
I was overwhelmed with the letter inviting me to accept the Berggruen Prize. As a government officer, I can't accept money for myself. But this was an opportunity to give money to many good causes. I was a bit taken aback because I'm truly not a philosopher, but I do interpret a text. The text I interpret most often is the U.S. Constitution. I can assure everyone here is indeed a living constitution, because who would want to be governed by a dead constitution? But I also consider myself an originalist in this sense. I think those founding fathers, if they meant that our fundamental instrument of government would control our society from generation to generation, then they must have known, they must have expected it would have growth potential.
Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, take a concept like the equal protection of the laws. That wasn't in the original Constitution. By the way, the original Constitution doesn't mention the word equal, even though in the Declaration of Independence it was a motivating idea that all men are created equal. That word doesn't appear in the Constitution, and the reason is obvious, because our Constitution preserved slavery, so it wasn't until after the Civil War that we got the equality guarantee written into the Constitution. No state shall deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. It came into the Constitution in 1868. If you ask the people who proposed and who ratified that amendment, well, is this going to end the subjugation of women? Yes, it would be. It had nothing to do with women. It had to do with the burning issue of the day to try to end the legacy of slavery.
When you consider something like that amendment, what you're talking about is the constant, vigilant reinterpretation of amendments of the Constitution.
Yes, and to become any person. There are many persons who were left out. But today, the Equal Protection Clause is guaranteed genuinely to all persons.
I wonder if I can just take you back now to when you first started and when you wanted to practice as a lawyer. At Harvard Law School, you were one of 9 women out of 500 male students. And when you graduated, not from Harvard, but from Columbia, I wonder what you set out to think about the kind of legal career that you thought you wanted, that you thought you could have.
Women were 3% of the lawyers in the country. There were precious few on any bench, precious few judges, and there was no law that prohibited discrimination on the basis of gender. So legal employers were upfront in saying they didn't want any lady lawyers. And in my case, they certainly didn't want a woman who was already a mother, because my daughter was almost 4 when I graduated from law school. So it was the closed door era.
And at the time, did you think that that's what you wanted to do, to devote your career to just to try and break that culture that lady lawyers, as you referred to them, were not going to be part of the fabric of the legal establishment?
Not when I was in law school. It took a revived feminist movement in the 1960s, heating up in the 1970s, I realized that things were not fair, but I didn't think there was much I could do about it. I got into the effort to make women citizens of equal stature to men. I was really driven by two forces. One were my students. The feminist movement was reborn, and my students wanted a course on women and the law. So I went to the library, and inside of a month, I read every federal decision it had ever written about gender-based discrimination. It was no mean feat. It was precious little out there. And then there were women coming into the ACLU. I was teaching at Rutgers University, so the affiliate in New Jersey, women who had complaints that they hadn't aired before. One group were teachers who were put on what was euphemistically called maternity leave as soon as they began to show. Because after all, you didn't want the little children to think the teacher had swallowed a watermelon. But these were women who said, we are ready, willing, and able to work, and there's no reason why we should be forced out of the classroom on unpaid leave with no guaranteed right to come back. And then there were blue-collar women who had factory jobs and wanted to get health insurance for their families. And they were told, family coverage is available to men, but not to women.
And how would you describe the way in which you attempted to shift perceptions as well as the law? What was the strategy that you adopted? Because we'd already seen in this country a huge shift with civil rights legislation.
There was a huge difference between racial discrimination, which everyone knew was odious. With respect to women, most people thought that all of the differentials in the law operated benignly in women's favor, that they were not adverse discrimination. So, for example, many states didn't call women for jury duty. That was considered a favor for women. But what was it really? It was, citizens should participate in the administration of justice. We need the men. They have no excuse. They must serve. But the women are expendable.
I wonder if you would reflect for us in the context of the progress that you made. We've heard about some 300 cases that were taken when you were involved with the American Civil Liberties Union to do with gender discrimination. Six of them were heard by the Supreme Court, five of which you won. I wonder whether you think that the sorts of progress that was made during your time with the American Civil Liberties Union, whether you think that those things are slowly coming under threat?
First, what was done in the 1970s was, in a sense, easy, because the law books, both federal and state, were riddled with gender-based discrimination differentials. And they all had been rationalized as operating benignly in women's favor. Our job was to show what Justice Brennan put so well in one of the decisions, that the pedestal on which women were thought to stand more often turned out to be a cage. So the mission in the 70s was to get rid of all these gender-based classifications. Man earns a living and deals with the outside world. Woman's domain is the home and children. Take Social Security. If a man dies, there are benefits for his widow. If a woman wage earner dies, there are no benefits for the widower, because she is considered a pin money earner, not the breadwinner who counts. With that separate spheres notion had to be torn down, and it was done by a combination of legislative change, court decisions. In the space of a decade, almost every explicit gender-based classification was gone. And those laws are not going to come back, ever.
I wonder if you would accept that there are laws that were passed then that are under threat now. When you look at the specifics of states in the south of this country, access to abortion is under threat. Do you think that women need to be, or society as a whole, not just women, needs to be ever more vigilant?
I think society needs to be more active on this issue. I mean, the truth is that with all these restrictive laws, the only people who are being restricted are poor women. There are some states...
And you say that because if you have money, you can travel to a state where you would be able to.
Yes. It's a little like divorce was in the old days, when if you had the money to go to Nevada and stay there for 6 weeks, you could get a divorce. Now we have no-fault divorce in every state. So no woman of means will ever lack access to abortion in the United States, because there's some states that will offer it. At the time of Roe v. Wade, there was California, Alaska, Hawaii, New York, and you could get an abortion, no questions asked, in the first trimester. But all the brunt of all of these restrictive laws is on poor women. Not only they can't pay the plane fare or the bus fare, they can't afford to take days off from work.
So when you say that society needs to be much more active,
yes,
to,
I think,
how do you think that should happen?
I think
happen?
One of the things that happened after Roe v. Wade is the women who wanted women to be able to control their own destiny, they won, so they retreated. One day, I think people will wake up to that reality, that we will never have a situation again where a woman of means has any problem.
Let's talk about the way in which we have seen in the last 5 years to a decade, this has been happening for some time. The polarization in society that we see today has been long in the making. And I wonder if you would reflect for us on the role of the Supreme Court as an institution in an environment, a cultural, social, and political environment where there is so much ideological polarization. How would you talk to people about the continued active role of the Supreme Court in that context?
Well, at first, it hasn't been so long in the making. Think back to the year that I was nominated by President Clinton.
1993.
I had been a co-founder of the ACLU's Women's Rights Project. I was one of the four general counsel to the ACLU. I was on the board of the ACLU. The vote in support of my nomination was 96-3. Orrin Hatch, the senator from Utah, was my chief supporter on the Judiciary Committee. My White House handlers were worried about my ACLU connection, and I said, forget it. Nothing that you can say to me that would lead me to do anything but praise the ACLU. There wasn't a single question, not a single question. There was no polarization. Congress was working the way it should. There was a true bipartisan spirit.
So how do you account for the polarization now, then?
How do we get back?
How do we get back to that? But how do you account for it? What is it that's the root cause of it, even if it's not been that long in the making?
I can't say more than anyone here can how this happened. But it's not the way it should be. And I hope that there will be good people on both sides of the aisle will say, let's stop this dysfunction. let's work together for the good of the country.
But it's quite clear that there is a huge lack of that effort of good people on both sides of the aisle coming together. This country is in the throes of an impeachment crisis, and I wonder if you would reflect for us this notion that senators should be impartial when the trial approaches, that this is something that is in the Constitution, the impartiality of senators, and that doesn't seem to be something that is likely to happen.
Well, we shall see what this process turns out.
Do you think they should be impartial?
The House indicts, and the Senate tries. Should a trier be impartial? Of course. That's the job of a judge, to be impartial.
But you will be very aware that there are senators who are already saying before the impeachment gets to the Senate or the trial in the Senate, they've already made their minds up.
Well, if a judge said that, a judge would be disqualified from sitting on the case. My old Chief Justice Rehnquist put it very well. He said, the day a judge stops being impartial and starts to do things to please the home crowd, whatever your home crowd is, that's the day that judge should step down from office.
So in that context, what you're saying is that you would urge senators to be impartial and to act as jurors as opposed to responding to their own ideological partisanship.
That's the role in which the Constitution casts the Senate for this purpose. They are the triers.
What's your reading of the Constitution in the context of the President of the United States saying that the Supreme Court should stop this impeachment? This is something that he has tweeted not that long ago. And I wonder what, if anything, exists in the Constitution which allows people to interpret that there is something that should be, some sort of response should be made when the head of the country says the impeachment should stop and the Supreme Court should intervene.
The president is not a lawyer. He's not law trained. So.
An observable fact.
But the truth is that the judiciary is a reactive institution. We don't have a program. We don't have an agenda. We react to what's out there. A very good Court of Appeals judge once said, the judges don't make the conflagrations, but they do the best they can to put them out.
Is there any circumstance in which, if the President of the United States says, I want to take this issue to the Supreme Court, would the Supreme Court even entertain that?
The Supreme Court has almost total control over its own docket. Ever since 1988, until 1988, there were certain cases that the court had to take up. But now, we get upwards of 6,000 petitions each year, and of those, we select between 70 and 80 to take up. The court's main job is to keep the law of the United States more or less uniform. So the large majority of the cases that we review are cases where other judges on other courts, state courts or federal courts, have disagreed on what the federal law is. The Supreme Court's function is not to correct errors made by lower courts. Every state has its own judiciary. On the federal level, there are trial courts and courts of appeals, and they do a good job of the everyday business of administering justice. But it's when courts divide, and it can be over the meaning of a constitutional provision, what constitutes an unreasonable search, to take a case we had a few years ago. When the police apprehend a suspect, they can take anything on the person. So this time they take not a wallet, but a cell phone. Can they examine what's in that cell phone? Other courts had divided about whether the police can do that. So the court established the rule, no, you can't. This is something different. This is, your whole life can be there. So that's what the court's job is. When other courts divide, and the Supreme Court will say what the law is. So we have one federal law and not a federal law for the West Coast and a different one for the East Coast.
How confident are you, as you have been throughout your legal career, that the robustness of the Constitution is still something that we can all have faith in?
I'm confident because of the history of the Constitution. Yes, there have been some bad periods, but on the whole, the Constitution has survived and the court has survived as an institution. And I can tell you that the one thing the nine of us feel strongly about is we don't want to do anything that will damage the court's standing in our society. We want to leave it in as good shape as we found it. And as different as we are, the court is the most collegial place I've ever worked.
Still?
Still, yes. And I can tell you that from a personal experience, surviving four cancer bouts when my colleagues rallied around me and made it possible for me not to miss a single case.
Let's talk about the popular iconic status that you have acquired and your view of it, whether you enjoy it for a start.
And I think it's an amazing phenomenon. Here I am, almost 87 years old, and everyone wants to take a picture with me. But I should tell you how it all started. It was started by a second-year student at New York University Law School. She started it when the Supreme Court decided a case involving the key provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The decision was divided. It cut the heart out of the Voting Rights Act. And this young woman was angry. And then she thought to herself, well, what good is that going to do me just to be angry? I have to do something positive. So she took the announcement of my dissent that I read from the bench, not the whole long dissent, but just the 5 minutes or so in which I summarized it. And she put it on some kind of a blog. And it took off from there into the wild blue yonder. And she called it the notorious RBG, after the famous rapper, the notorious B.I.G., because she decided that the two of us had something very important in common.
It obviously gives you a great deal of joy that this has happened.
But I had to tell you what we had in common, because you wouldn't think of it immediately. What we had in common is that we were both born and bred in Brooklyn, New York.
You've seen so much change and so much progress, and you are vigilant about that progress not going backwards. I wonder what you would say to young people who you talk to all the time and people come and seek your advice. What would you say to young women who look at your example and are either despondent in the current climate that progress is not possible? What would you say to them?
Well, the young people are my hope. Well, my granddaughter, who is here tonight, who is doing what she can to make things better in our society. Think of Malala. Think
Malala of Yousafzai?
The Swedish,
Greta Thunberg. Yeah.
Yeah. I think at least the young people that I see are fired up. And they want our country to be what it should be. One of the things that makes me an optimist are the young people.
Justice Ginsburg, thank you very much for speaking to us. Thank you for being with us.
I'm Razia Iqbal, and I was speaking to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.